132 of Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry. I'm your host, Jeff Bowdrin. With me, my man from Ambler, PA, sweet Barry Rose. How you doing today, Barry?
I'm doing good. I haven't completely lost my entire mind based off of what's going on. More importantly, Jeff, as we look every week, we want to get an update from you to see how you're doing as you still are fighting this, you know, shitty disease called cancer. But how is your family doing with all, not just dealing with you, but also with everything that's going on in the world right now with the coronavirus?
Well, I'm happy to say that we have some good news from the Bowdrin family front. My father was finally released from his rehabilitation facility yesterday. He's back home with his bride of some, get a load of this, Barry. Like, he's getting ready to celebrate the big 6-9 on the anniversary. Holy cats. Can you imagine being married to Mrs. Rose for 69 years? More importantly, can Mrs. Rose imagine being married to you?
Yeah. If we make it out of the coronavirus without going through divorce court, that's going to be a miracle. So your family, Jeff, if we look at it, your parents have been married. So both of your parents are in their 90s, correct? I know your father is.
I do not want to put that on my mother. She is not yet 90 and would be extremely resentful if you said that.
Absolutely. So your father's in his 90s. Your mother is in her 80s. You worked at the courthouse for what, close to 35 years?
Yep.
There is a longevity factor in everything that the Bowdrin family does. You notice that?
I noticed that. But so we got my brother who's post-recovery from open heart surgery and doing great. And I'm going to now break kayfabe to Sweet Lou and to Barry some news that I received. I was initially supposed to check in for my second round of chemo treatment that was rescheduled till Monday. We're recording on Saturday. So by the time this drops, I will be back in for another 5-day stint of chemo. However, I'm happy to report that after visiting with my doctor yesterday, he is extremely, extremely happy with how things are progressing so far with my blood work, et cetera, and says that if things continue along this line, I may only be needing 3 treatments instead of the expected 6. And that, needless to say, is extremely, extremely good news. But whenever your doctor's happy with the way things are going, you know, I'm happy. Let's put it that way, Barry.
Yeah, absolutely, too. And, Jeff, you can hear it in your voice. Hey, you sound fantastic. Don't sound like what you're going through currently. But at the same time, you do sound very enthusiastic and positive. And that is the best possible news, I would assume, at this stage that you could possibly be receiving.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm still struggling with the appetite, you know, looking into some ways of dealing with that. And so, but I'm at a spelt 202, Barry. This
wow.
is the lightest I've been since the first Mrs. Bowdrin, who shall not be named. So on today's episode, Barry, we are going to be going to AWA savant George Shire, who's had a great first appearance with us. We enjoyed it so much. We decided to have him back. George is going to discuss, Barry, the top 10 angles in the history of the AWA, the American Wrestling Association. That'll be good times as well. Barry and I are going to finish off that classic 1000 classic rock songs. And I know, Barry, you're going to be really happy just to be done with that damn thing.
I never want to talk about that again. I'm super excited. I'm really super excited to have George Shire on with us. And it was something that when he and I were speaking, we really haven't given the AWA a lot of love. We talk about promotions, regional promotions, territories going back 60s, 70s, and 80s. But with the AWA, we haven't done a whole lot. And really, who better to walk us down the path of the glory of the AWA than the authority himself, George Shire?
George, welcome, my friend.
Hey, it's great to be on with you guys. Jeff, I'm glad to hear about your great news. That's exciting. I know it's not easy going through the old cancer thing. You know, I'm dealing with it in my own household with my beautiful wife who's struggling with it right now. And with the coronavirus and everything else, there's a lot on the plate for everybody in the world today. So congratulations to you, and continued best wishes to you.
Thank you. I do appreciate that, sir. And, again, that's very early stages of the game. We hope that we can continue along those lines. And before we start with George, I do want to make quick mention, Barry, our good friend Neely Shockett, released from the hospital after his situation with a gallbladder. And we know he's back home. He posted recently, Neely, we're glad to have you back with us. And I know your wife is extremely happy to have you home. So now that being said, George, we offer up to you your choices for the 10 best angles in the history of the AWA. So why don't we jump right into that? Give us your number 10 angle of all time.
Well, if I give you number 10, it's actually fairly recent. When I say recent, I'm talking towards the end of the AWA as a viable promotion back in the 80s. And it's kind of a weird one because I'm going to mention the Road Warriors. And when I do that, I will tell you guys firsthand that I have always, since about 5 years old, 6 years old, which is quite a few years ago, I have always loved tag team wrestling. In fact, it's always been my favorite type of wrestling because I've always felt there are so many great storylines that can be worked into a great tag team run or a program between four guys. So the Road Warriors come along in the AWA in the early 80s. And I don't have to tell any modern day fan or anybody that's 50 years old and younger that the Road Warriors were a different kind of a tag team because they came into the ring in any territory they were in. And they had a style that was different than anything we'd ever seen before in that they just charged the ring and they never really waited for introductions or anything. They just started kicking ass with the team they were going to be against. And very seldom would they return the favor and sell anything from the other team. They were very aggressive, very abrasive in their style. And Vern Gagne brought the Road Warriors in at a time when he'd already lost Hulk Hogan. We don't need to go into that at this point. He had lost Hulk Hogan through the Vince McMahon expansion endeavor that was going to take place. He'd lost a lot of other AWA stars, and he brings in the Road Warriors at the encouragement of Ole Anderson, who had started the Warriors. And Vern and Ole were always fairly close and good friends. In fact, Vern trained Ole for the business back in the 60s. But the Road Warriors come in, and Vern tried his darndest to make them heels. And based on their style and their interviews and everything, the average fan who'd ever followed wrestling would have said, hey, they're heels. They're maybe the best heels we've ever seen because nobody can beat them. But they come in and they just do their, as I said earlier, their kick-ass style. And what happens is that no matter how hard Vern tried, the fans cheered him. And it seemed to be that it didn't matter who they were against. And one of the greatest babyface teams we had at the time, who, by the way, were actually promised a run with the tag team title, the AWA title, the Fabulous Ones, which I know, Barry, you should be very familiar with them. They were in here extremely over with the fans. And again, a different kind of a tag team because the wrestling had changed so much in the early 80s with rock and wrestling and all this stuff and music videos to the entrances of all the wrestlers. But the Fabulous Ones were over. And they put them against the Road Warriors. And the fans basically are booing the Fabs and cheering the Warriors. It's one of those things like, what's going on here? What do you do? And any team that Vern put them against, the Warriors just basically dominated their style the way it was supposed to be done, I guess, back at that time. Here's where I think one of the angles comes into play that a lot of fans today still complain about if you talk about the Road Warriors and the AWA. Vern, what I think in hindsight, did something he should not have done. He put the tag team title on the Warriors and basically stiffed the Fabs. And there was some tension there, and the Fabs weren't around much longer after that. But the Warriors got the championship. Now, one of the things, I guess, from an old school standpoint, anytime you have a champion, be a tag team and or singles champ, I always think it's been important that the champion be able to show that he's vulnerable, that a challenger could beat him, or that he was beaten, but somehow he saved his title. The same with a tag team. Whether they double teamed or, you know, hid something from the referee or whatever they did and saved their title. But with the Road Warriors, they were such an aggressive team that they obviously were a team that no matter who Vern Gagne would put against them, the team was not believable to beat the Road Warriors. It didn't matter who it was. Even Greg Gagne and Jim Brunzel tried. In fact, they also received boos against the Road Warriors, which was very unusual because the High Flyers were always over big in the AWA. So you've got these Warriors as the champions, and then you got two guys like the Warriors who I think we could safely say they kind of marched to the beat of their own drummer along the lines of guys like Stan Hansen and Bruiser Brody. But they wanted to do things their way. And the question then gets to the point where who is going to beat them? Who can take the title off of them? Well, eventually, they're going to leave. They don't want to lose the title. So Vern came up, and this is an angle that I thought was, in hindsight, probably one of the greatest genius promoting ideas in the world. You're never going to have two guys be able to beat the Road Warriors and make it believable, because the Warriors, along with Paul Ellering as their sidekick, it just wasn't believable no matter who the team was. So Vern set it up where there was a feud between the Warriors and the Freebirds. Now, you have three Freebirds at the time, Terry Gordy, Buddy Roberts, and Michael Hayes. They had confrontations in the AWA, and they are in Chicago. They have a big confrontation where it looks like the Freebirds are going to win the title, but the Road Warriors, of course, keep the title. The following night in St. Paul, the Road Warriors are signed to wrestle the unlikely team of Steve Regal, who was Mr. Electricity, and I'm not talking the Steve Regal later on in the WCW territory. I'm talking the Indianapolis version. Steve Regal and Gorgeous Jimmy Garvin are a team. Now, on the surface, you would never picture Garvin and Regal to ever be champions, nor could they beat the Road Warriors. But on this particular night, Vern worked it out, and it had to have been planned by all the guys and went along with it. But the idea being that in order to show that the Warriors couldn't be beat, he had to bring in five guys. And at ringside during the Garvin Regal Warrior match were the three Freebirds. Well, you know, when they're at ringside, they're going to get into it. And they were playing the angle that the night before they got screwed out of the title, the Freebirds were. And so here you've got it, one of the most exciting matches back and forth. The Warriors are doing their best, but eventually you've got a 5-on-2 situation. And when it all was clear, Steve Regal gets a pin over the Warrior, Animal Warrior, and the Garvin Regal team are the champions. Now, there wasn't a fan in the place that didn't boo. I never heard booing so loud in my whole life. And I mean, they were booing for a team that had just been screwed in the fans' eyes by the Warriors. But the idea being that in hindsight, it was the only logical thing to do. And I think that was an angle that Vern did well, after making the mistake of putting the title on them in the first place, because you had a team that there was no way to explain them ever being beat and make it seem real. And that was the idea still back in 1984, that wrestling was presented as real. And so I put it as my number 10 just because it's just something that is genius to me, the way they pulled it off. And shortly after, the Warriors were gone and they were pretty much history, and then the AWA cart sort of went downhill after that. But that was a great way to end the World Warrior reign, and that would be my number 10.
Well, George, let me ask you a quick question. Since you got a chance to see both teams, compare and contrast, if you will, the Road Warriors and Bruiser and Crusher as tag teams, because they basically were the same thing, weren't they?
You know, I've had people over the years, guys, say that, yeah, Bruiser and Crusher were the Road Warriors of their era. And I will tell you that, yes, Crusher and Bruiser had a style. And I want to go back to the Crusher and the Bruiser of the 60s now, when they first teamed up in the AWA. Their first time was in 63, when Vern dubbed them as cousins, even though they had teamed together a couple of times years before and not been cousins. And they had wrestled against each other and evidently never realized that they were cousins, right? The Crusher and Bruiser of the 60s and the very early 70s, they were very aggressive in the ring. They at least sold for their opponents. If they were in the ring against Larry Hennig and Harley Race, or against Mad Dog and Butcher Vachon, or against the Kelmikoff brothers or the Blackjacks, Lanza and Mulligan, whatever team it was, the Crusher and the Bruiser would still let the other team have their moments. And I think that was the major difference between them and the Warriors, is that the Warriors just would not. All the times I saw them wrestle, I just never saw them give any other wrestler a break. I mean, the wrestler could hit him over the head with a chair and neither one of them would sell it. It just seemed to me like it was, I don't know, I personally didn't have a lot of respect for the style that they offered, but it was something at the time that was selling in wrestling because fans loved it and the fans were paying to see them. So, I mean, it made sense to put them over. I just didn't think it made sense to put the title on them. But yeah, they were, Crusher and Bruiser were definitely the Road Warriors of the 60s, very early 70s. And then as the 70s moved on, you know, Crusher and Bruiser were starting to show their age. There's no doubt that by the time they got into their 50s, that they were not the Crusher Bruiser that we'd known earlier, that they were slower and a lot more methodical in the ring. And since you brought them up with the Road Warriors, here's one thing that has always struck a nerve with me. The Crusher and the Bruiser did wrestle against the Road Warriors. And they were asked before the match by both Bruiser and Crusher, by the Road Warriors, do not body slam us. Don't be slamming us down on the mat. Now, here's the thing. Number one, there's a side of me that says, you know, Bruiser and Crusher, that's part of the business. You should be able to do it or get out of the ring. But on the other hand, Bruiser and Crusher were just such a tremendous draw that you put them together on any AWA card, any WWA card, and the fans packed to see that team. They could have teamed them every week, and the fans would have paid to see the Crusher and the Bruiser together. And because of that long history together and individually as singles wrestlers in their respective territories, by name value, they always put butts in the seats. So for that factor alone, by the time they're in their 50s and they're still drawing against, you know, probably better than a lot of the younger wrestlers at the time, when they go against the Road Warriors, the Warriors should have respected that fact and not. What the Warriors did was as soon as they got into the match with Crusher and Bruiser, they body slammed the Bruiser high over Animal's head and slammed him to the mat. It was stuff like that that I looked at, and you knew there was friction with Bruiser right away because they just weren't showing the respect. It was a different era, and we could discuss that and how wrestling has progressed on about 10 shows worth, and we're not going to go there. But I think that was the deal with the Warriors. They ushered in a whole new style of wrestling, and they couldn't be beat. And it was popular. I mean, what do I know in hindsight? They were over. So I hope I answered your question about Crusher and Bruiser.
Yeah, you absolutely did answer that question too, George. And so one of the things, and two, I know that our producer, Sweet Lou Kippelman, the North Bay Stud Muffin, is going to have jump in with a question in a minute. But so you're talking about the Road Warriors and respect of the opponents. Obviously, it sounds like they kind of disrespected the Bruiser and the Crusher right there. But this is a match that I saw from the AWA some years back, and it was a televised match, and it was the Road Warriors working with Ken Lucas and a partner. And I don't know who the partner was, but I guess the focus was Ken Lucas looked like he was getting the snot beat out of him. And apparently, from something that I had read, was Ken Lucas, the Road Warriors were not cooperating with him, and I guess they were really stiff with him and really laying it in. And Ken Lucas, this would have been obviously mid-80s. At that stage, was probably a 20-year vet, had worked territories, and an excellent, excellent worker, but was completely disrespected by the Road Warriors. From your knowledge in the AWA at that time, if you know anything about that match, I would love to hear it, but was there any heat on the Road Warriors backstage for the fact that they were going into business for themselves?
I don't know anything about the Lucas match you're speaking of. And with no disrespect to Ken Lucas, I mean, I have the utmost respect for any wrestler that ever laced up boots and put on trunks and got into the ring, regardless of what their stature was in the business. I always want that clarified. But with no disrespect to Lucas, he didn't have the star power that a Crusher did or a Bruiser did. And to disrespect Crusher and Bruiser the way the Warriors did, and they did it a couple of times. Another wrestler that had some issues with the Road Warriors was Larry Hennig. Now, Larry Hennig, by the mid-80s, was at the end of his career. The only time he was really wrestling was when he was working with Kurt, his son. And that was basically just to, you know, help get Kurt over and have the joy of working with his son. But Larry Hennig was another huge draw and a big, powerful guy in his career. And he went into the ring with the Warriors. And Larry told me personally, he says, I couldn't get them to do anything. They were going to do what they wanted to do no matter what. And he said it was one of the worst. I told Vern, I'm not wrestling against him again. I'm not going to go in with him because we can't have a match. And when you've got that type of stuff going on behind the scenes, I think the Warriors, you know, I don't know either of them. And like I say, I respect them for what they did. But, you know, as far as workers in the business, but I don't respect the fact that they disrespected so many established stars. Because at the time in the 80s, the early 80s, the Road Warriors were pretty green in the business at this point yet. They'd only been around for 3, 4, 5 years. And they just didn't show the respect to those that paved the way before them.
Got it. Sweet Lou, you had a question for George Shire. If you're just joining us too, which means you have not been listening to Breaking Kayfabe with Boudrin and Barry from
and
the very
dare
beginning.
You, by the way.
Yes.
Exactly.
Turn off your vacuum cleaner and pay attention.
Please do that. We have the authority. I would say this is arguably not just as far as the AWA, but as far as professional wrestling, one of the most knowledgeable researchers or historians. We have the authority, George Shire. But Sweet Lou, you had a question for George?
So I know George had brought up, of course, the passing of the AWA tag belts from the Road Warriors to Garvin and Regal. And you had referenced the day before the match between the Road Warriors and the Freebirds. That was, of course, at Super Clash 1 at Comiskey Park in Chicago.
A match I believe you reviewed, Barry.
Yeah, that's right. A long time ago, right, Jeff?
Yes, we did.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's the one thing I remember in particular from that match was this sort of convoluted finish in that, of course, the Freebirds cheated behind the referee's back, got the three count, and ostensibly won the belts. And then, almost like a deus ex machina, Vern Gagne comes out and says, let's look at a replay of the finish on the Comiskey Park Jumbotron. And then based off that, they changed it from the belts going to the Freebirds to a disqualification. It seemed kind of gimmicky to me. And it was also, I don't know if Vern had in mind that he didn't, you know, even if he wanted the Road Warriors to drop the straps, maybe perhaps he didn't want to do that in the Road Warriors storyline hometown of Chicago. Just wondering, do you know any sort of the behind the scenes machinations on why that particular finish was used?
I guess I cannot answer to that as to why it was used, but you know, I will say that because we were in such a turbulent time when this took place in the AWA, and again, all territories were under fire at this point in time with the McMahon expansion happening and wrestlers leaving and going to the WWF at the time. And I refer to it as WWF because that's what it was at the time. But the thing with the Freebirds and the Warriors, I can tell you firsthand that neither of the five of them were on the greatest terms with Vern Gagne. Again, Vern was using the Freebirds a lot out of the Dallas territory at the time or having come off of that. And there was so much turbulence in the AWA that I don't think anybody trusted anybody for about a 2 or 3 year period, probably less than they ever did in the first place. I don't know. But why he did that particular thing, if it was maybe it was planned just the way they were going to do it, that it was going to be a 5-on-1 the next night. I mean, it went over really well in the Civic Center because you saw the three Freebirds coming out and they lined up on three opposite sides of the ring and they just taunted the Road Warriors and they were interfering in their own little way. And it just was so unlikely that Regal and Garvin would be the champions, especially Regal. I mean, Garvin had some star stature to him, but Regal had been pretty much a lower mid-card guy, if anything, in the AWA before that, and had been a junior heavyweight or a light heavyweight, as they were calling him at the time. And it just didn't seem likely. But the Warriors were going to leave. The Freebirds were not that strong with Vern in the first place. And I think it was just the ending right there. Riegel and Garvin got it, and the other five were pretty much disappearing from the scene at that point.
So, okay, before we get to number nine, George, on your list of the top 10 AWA angles, I want to compliment Lou for, I believe, the first use, Barry, of Latin on this. What was it? Deus ex machina? Sweet Lou.
Deus ex machina. Anybody familiar with ancient Greek theater would know that phrase.
Yeah. Yeah. All of our listeners are. They're all
that's a biggie with our fans here.
I'll post a Wikipedia link on the group.
Thank you. I do appreciate that. Okay, so George, our number nine choice of yours is actually an angle that is based on a real life situation. That involves Harley Race coming back from his knife injury.
This was a situation where I loved the way wrestling, you know, we all know about kayfabe and we know how important it was for wrestlers, the heels, to get their heat. And how the baby faces had to be loved. When Harley Race and Larry Hennig won the AWA tag team title in January of 65, about two and a half weeks later, after they won the title, Harley Race was in a downtown Minneapolis nightclub with, would have been unknown to hear this at the time, but he was there with Eddie Sharkey, a baby face, and Rene Goulet, a babyface. They were at the nightclub, the Chestnut Tree. There was a ruckus that took place. There were three black guys that were beating up on a lady in the bar. Now, the lady could have been a lady of the evening. Nobody really knows, but nonetheless, the three guys were mishandling her. The owner of the Chestnut Tree asked Harley if he would maybe kind of put himself into the hustle here and maybe break this up. Harley went in, and Rene Goulet and Eddie Sharkey, Rene Goulet, bless his heart, just passed away. Of course, we just found out about it, but he passed away in May of a year ago. Eddie Sharkey has told this story a few times. So the way it's being told is exactly the way it happened. Harley went in and took out two of the guys that were beating up on the lady, basically knocked them down. The third guy came up behind Harley and took out a pocket knife, I guess you'd call it a jackknife or whatever it was, and he put it into Harley's back, right on the side of his heart, his left side. Harley went down. He'd been wounded, just taken to the hospital. Harley was out of action for about 3 weeks. It was one of the few times when the AWA, and usually promotions don't do this, but they came out and they basically broke kayfabe and said on All-Star Wrestling that Harley Race was a hero, that he had likely saved this woman's life. He took this knife to the back. They may have exaggerated a little bit that it came within inches of his heart and he was struggling for his life, but nonetheless, he was in the hospital, and I have clippings of that in my collection. He was in the hospital in Minneapolis recuperating. So he's out of action. He misses his commitments that he and Hennig have as new tag team champions. Now, the interesting thing was, is that obviously the match has to go on. So Larry Hennig said he was going to get a substitute partner, and it was nobody's business who it was. And he comes out with a guy he identified simply as Masked Man. And here's this guy with a mask on, just Masked Man. He was asked by Marty O'Neill, who is it? None of your business. And so the Masked Man and Larry go ahead and fill the commitments for the next couple of weeks of he and Race. And the title was mentioned that it wasn't on the line due to the substitution, but nonetheless, they had to have the match. Now comes time for Harley to come back. And this was one of the things that, to me, I was only at the time I was 14 years old. It just seemed like such a magic moment to me because I think it was the time that I really got it, how important it was for a heel to get heat. All-Star Wrestling starts. Larry Hennig comes into the ring, and Marty O'Neill, our announcer, we talked about him on a previous show. He comes into the ring and he's introducing to the studio audience fans, Harley Race is back. And here he comes, Harley Race fans, and he tells the story. The entire studio audience, which is about 150 people in the studio audience, They cheer like you wouldn't believe. Harley gets this standing ovation. Well, now we know as heels, that's not good. So the match starts, the bell rings, and Harley starts the match. He's charged over. We talked about the Road Warriors a minute ago. Harley charged at his opponent and started kicking the living crap out of him and pounding on his partner in the corner, the tag team partner, and just literally kicking butt. And it was less than 30 seconds, and the fans in the studio were booing the ever-loving hell out of him. And I just, as an angle, I said, that's when it did it for me, that Harley knew he had to get his heat back, and the only way he was going to do it by what he did. And he was a heel just like that, and they'd forgotten already his good deed. And that's always been one of my favorite, I guess I'd call it an angle, because Harley had to get his heat back.
Well, let me ask you, I noticed, I'm not going to jump ahead here, but I noticed that Harley and Larry Hennig are involved in at least three of your top 10. So when you look back, and we've talked last episode about the Ray Stevens, Nick Bockwinkel team and how great they were. And of course, there are a lot of great teams in the AWA, but where would you place in the pantheon of teams that appeared in the AWA, Larry Hennig and Harley Race?
Well, if I want to be unbiased, that may be a little tough, because I think from the 60s through the end of the AWA, I think there are four. There are four teams that could juggle around for best of all time in the AWA. One is Hennig and Race. Two is Crusher and Bruiser, without any doubt. Then I think Stevens and Bockwinkel. And then I think the Vachons. You could interchange them as to who was the greatest. But Hennig and Race, I think, personally, they're my all-time favorite team. So I admit that up front. I may be a little bit prejudiced on that. I just think that Hennig and Race, for their longevity, for the 5 years they were together, and the money they drew together, I think that makes them one of the best.
Gotcha. Well, today being, as we're recording this, the 77th anniversary of the birthday of Harley Race. George, in looking at the champions of the AWA, the two that I think stand out above everybody else, Otto Wanz obviously was in the mix, but it was Vern Gagne, it was Nick Bockwinkel. It was really, in my opinion, and I think for the average wrestling fan, it was Bockwinkel and it was Vern Gagne. How would Harley Race, which for so many years, maybe one of the other than Ric Flair, one of the longest reigning NWA World's Heavyweight Champions, how would he have fit into the scheme of things if he had been an AWA World's Heavyweight Champion?
I think I'm going to answer your question, but I think you forgot somebody if we want to be fair.
Sure.
If you look at the AWA from the beginning to the end, there were really only three guys, Vern, Nick, and Mad Dog Vachon, that had the longevity as the champions and had the drawing power that they did. All of the other champions, you mentioned Otto Wanz, and we had Rick Martel and Jumbo Tsuruta and different guys in there. I mean, early years, you had Mr. M, Bill Miller, you had Gene Kaniski. For all of these guys were champions basically for the old proverbial coffee break.
Whereas Fritz von Erich, too, correct?
Fritz von Erich, yeah. But again, just a short, there were a lot of these short couple week type title changes. And in the scheme of things, I think you got to put the dog in there, because for 3 years, he was the champ. And then Bockwinkel had it for five, the first run, almost five. And of course, Vern off and on for the entire AWA. So history of the AWA. But Harley Race, it's an interesting thing, because Harley Race told this story and Larry Hennig tells the same story, or did tell the same story. Hennig and Race probably would not have broken up as a team if Larry would have wanted to travel. And Larry didn't. He traveled around the AWA, easy record, or the travel that they had. But he didn't want to go to other territories. He wasn't fond of taking off for months or years at a time and go to a different part of the country and stay there.
He was a bit
and
of a homesteader.
Harley, right. To his blessing, he was home with his family. He was a homebody. He wanted to take care of his family. and he had a real estate license on the side. He was wise enough to know that if he got hurt in wrestling or wrestling didn't take, you know, pay him anymore, he'd had real estate to fall back on, which he did up until the day he passed away a year and a half ago. And Harley Race was restless. Harley Race was a traveler. He wanted to move. And by the time 67, 68 came along, Harley was ready to move on. And Larry didn't want to. And both of the guys have said this, that if they would have stayed together, you know, they could have went anywhere. And who knows what would have happened. But Harley in the AWA, he had matches against Vern Gagne in 1968 and 69 before he left, singles matches. And I guess Harley at that point, I think he had his eyes on moving back to Kansas City and taking over, getting a part of the Central States promotion, which he bought into. The NWA was, you know, probably already grooming him. I don't know. Terry, I know the Funks liked him. And in the AWA, I think if he'd had a run as champion, he certainly, you know, in 69 or 70, it may have still just been a little bit too early. But had he stayed around, yeah, I think he could have been up there with a Bockwinkel or Mad Dog for the longevity factor. It's just that time for him to move on, and he did.
Okay, so let me go to number 8 here. And since you just mentioned Nick Bockwinkel, it involves Nick and his battles with Sheikh Adnan Al-KC. Tell us your thoughts on that angle with Mr. Class, Mr. Beverly Hills, Nick Bockwinkel.
Well, this is one of those things where, you know, I look at a lot of these angles from a 20, 30-year perspective away from them, and I look at how people react to them on Facebook and on wrestling boards and different things and how they talk about it. And, you know, it seems like there's a lot of, you know, the old term, the armchair quarterback. Everybody seems to have what they think they should have done, could have done, why they didn't, why they, you know, however. One of the most controversial things that happened in the AWA was when in May of 1991, Vern Gagne retired after his match with Nick Bockwinkel on May 10th. And the idea of the whole match, the entire year that Vern had been champion leading up to this, after he'd taken the belt back from Nick a year before, the whole objective of this was Vern putting himself over as the champion one last time, staying in kayfabe, the storyline being that he's the aging champion and he wants to go out on top. Can he do it? No, you know, they tell the story. No champion has ever retired with the belt, and Vern wants to be the first. Will he be the first? You know, has he gotten too old? Is Nick or somebody else bigger, better than he is? So the year-long storyline is so good. And then going back to what I said earlier about Crusher and Bruiser, even though they were in their 50s, Vern now is in his 50s. And I can tell you firsthand, Vern Gagne in 1981 was not the same Vern Gagne that I saw back in 1961 or even 71. That Vern Gagne had slowed down. That Vern Gagne was more of a mat worker than a high flyer that he had been. Anybody who didn't see Vern Gagne in 1960 or during the 60s, even during the 50s, I remember him in 58 and 59. The guy was, he was all over the ring and he was a whirlwind. He was exciting to watch. So you get to 1981 and you got to remember it's hometown as well. Vern's right here in the Twin Cities. He's trying to go out as champion. And he's going to go against his number one challenger, his biggest adversary at that point, Nick Bockwinkel. This is Nick's last chance. Vern, he wants to spoil Vern's idea of going out as a winner. And, you know, that's the whole storyline. So there's a great storyline to it. And Vern had the drawing power because his name was Vern Gagne, and especially in the Twin Cities, he was a huge draw. Whenever he was on a card, attendance was up. That's a fact that can be documented. So, again, he may not be the Vern Gagne of 10 or 20 years earlier, but his name is still Vern Gagne. Well, lo and behold, he beats Nick Bockwinkel, and he goes out as the world champion. They have this big celebration. Now, here's where all the controversy comes in, and this is where the armchair quarterbacks come into the picture. I don't know if there was a plan to say, okay, Vern's going to retire as champion. I think it was decided right up front that Nick was going to get the title back for being so loyal to Vern. And if you ever talked to Nick Bockwinkel, and I did many times, he was loyal to Vern. He said, Vern paid me well. I did what Vern asked me to do. Vern always took care of me. And so I think as a reward, it was automatic that when Vern retired, Nick was going to get the title back. Well, what they did is, you know, the fictional president of the AWA, Stanley Blackburn, announces that it would take months to hold a tournament and have elimination matches to determine a new champion. And the AWA cannot be without a world champion because we've got commitments that have been signed. You know, they use the whole storyline that promoters have already got matches with a champion signed. So they awarded Nick Bockwinkel, based on his previous record, they awarded him the title. That, to this very day, for anybody that doesn't understand wrestling, has always been one of the sore spots because people say, why did Nick just get it handed to him? They should have had a tournament or even one elimination match, something. Well, that's possible. I guess it could be handled that way. But Nick got the belt, and it was very unpopular. Very unpopular. So here's where the next genius angle comes into play. The AWA, Vern Gagne, put Nick Bockwinkel as the new AWA champion, got him into a program with the much more hated Sheik Adnan El Casey. Now, the Sheik, at that point, was always bragging that he was going to win the title and he was going to take it back to Iraq and he was never going to come back here to America and he was going to make charge of the promoters lots of money to have them defend. And so what they do is they have this series of matches with Nick Bockwinkel against Sheik. They even went so far as to have, before the match started, when Bobby Heenan climbed up on the ring apron, now naturally Bobby could be the factor here because he's Nick's manager. They had the Sheik take Heenan out by taking the Sheik's sword and crossed Bobby Heenan's forehead, forcing him to bleed, carried out, Bobby's out of the picture. The fans in the three matches against the Sheik were 100% behind Nick Bockwinkel and America. And they're yelling, USA, USA, USA. Nick was the babyface. That, to me, was a genius way to get the fans to accept Nick, because when the Sheik feud was over, the fans, and I don't say this disrespectfully, but most wrestling fans don't remember a couple months back, and they had forgotten how Nick got the title, and they were no longer upset. Now they just wanted the next babyface to beat Nick, and Nick was back to being a heel. And so that Sheik series, I think that was one of the most genius things Vern could have ever done, because it took all the heat away from Nick being handed the title in that particular situation.
So, George, so in looking at it with Bockwinkel and Sheik Adnan El Casey, too, and I actually I interviewed Casey probably 15 years ago when his autobiography was released. And we spent about 45 minutes on the phone. We discussed his time in Florida. It was interesting because obviously he had a very varied career. He had gone to college in the States, was a tremendous amateur wrestler. His career began back in the 50s, if I'm correct. And we saw him in Florida in 1975 as a babyface, and he was a very solid babyface. Do you think that Casey as a babyface in the AWA could have gotten over?
Well, I have no doubt that he probably could have if he'd have come in as, the Olympic type wrestler, Adnan Casey, that Vern always enjoyed, and he worked in that type of a situation. Yeah, I think he could have. I think he had the personality that Vern could have worked with to make him a top babyface, or he could have come in his Billy White Wolf persona. You know, it had been a while since Wahoo McDaniel had been around by that time, and it could have worked. Yeah. I do know that Nick and Adnan were good friends outside the ring. Adnan was one of the really one of the few wrestlers that Nick had invited to his 60th birthday party here in the Twin Cities. And I don't know if I'd mentioned to you guys or not, but I was invited to that party as well. And it was one of those times where, this was back in 1994, and it was one of those times when I was in the room and I was in kind of awe because we had Jim Brunzel, we had Larry Hennig, we had Kurt Hennig, we had Sheik. There were a couple of other wrestlers there. And I felt like, how do I fit into, and not along with that, all of Nick's friends, the golf club that he belonged to there and his personal friends and stuff. And I actually asked Nick, I said to him, I said, I just want to thank you for inviting me to the party here tonight. I said, this is great. And that was the night that Nick looked at me and he said, you earned the right to be here. And that's one of those little moments that you always cherish.
No, absolutely.
And but Sheik was there, and Sheik was telling a story that night about when he and Nick were rooming together during a Hawaii tour when they were there together some years earlier. Sheik had been there as White Wolf.
So I've always heard that Nick, we mentioned that he enjoyed his time in the AWA and that Vern certainly took care of him. But that, like, during the 70s, Nick was a guy that was up for consideration for the NWA title. Have you ever heard those stories, or did Nick ever tell you anything about that?
Nick told me that personally on my deck in 1996 when I did an interview with him for Scott Teal's Whatever Happened To publication that was around at that time. And in fact, I think it's in his, he's got an archives edition that he published in book form here maybe a year or two back. I think that interview was in there. But yeah, Nick told the story that Fritz Von Erich was pushing for Nick to get a title run shortly around the time that Vern had probably, I think Vern put the title on Nick already. And Nick, in long story short, told me that he had sat down real quick and he did the math. He asked Fritz how many nights Harley's working. And Harley was working at that point in time about 365 days a year with no days off. And really, travel wise, the NWA champion, they were traveling all over the place. I mean, they're in Toronto one night and Houston the next, and then they're over in Japan, and then they're out in, all over the place. And so Harley had no rest. And Nick says he did the math, and Harley was making about the same amount of money that Nick was with Vern. And with Vern, he was only working, as he said, 6 months a year, because he would work maybe two or three nights a week and have the rest of the time off. And so you equated out, it ended up being that he had the lesser schedule. And he said, plus he had time to be home and be with his family. And he said, so he told Fritz he wasn't interested. Also told Jim Barnett that he wasn't interested in an NWA run. But that is a true story.
Okay, let's go to number seven, as we have Vern Gagne challenging Pat O'Connor for the NWA title.
I think that's an interesting angle because that's where it all starts. And it's also one of the most continuous, controversial angle storylines in AWA history. If you go to a lot of wrestling websites, if they give the title histories, there are many of them that list Pat O'Connor as the first AWA world champion. And that's one of the things that's always been a bone of contention for me, because Pat O'Connor never, put never in capital letters, never held the AWA title. And the storyline that the fans were given, and then there's also what was going on behind the scenes, the storyline to the fans on both All-Star Wrestling TV and in the wrestling programs that were sold at the arenas, St. Paul and Minneapolis, the storyline was, in May of 1960, Vern Gagne and Wally Carbo, Wally Carbo being the spokesperson for the AWA, or the wrestling office, the Minneapolis Wrestling Club, had given an ultimatum to the NWA, because Minneapolis was under the NWA umbrella all through the 50s. And from 1959, in September, when Vern and Wally bought the promotion, the Minneapolis Wrestling Club, from Dennis Stecker and family, Dennis had been the Minneapolis promoter at that time, the whole storyline for that year was Vern wants to get the NWA champion in the ring. Well, at the time, it was O'Connor who was the champ. So in May of 60, they put out this storyline that the ultimatum has been given, that Pat O'Connor and the NWA will defend the title to Vern Gagne within 90 days, or Pat O'Connor will no longer be recognized as the world champion. Well, it was never going to happen. Now, the behind the story is that the NWA had already agreed to get out of Minneapolis, to leave Minneapolis, the home office for the wrestling club, to get out of the territory. And part of that had to do with the justice investigation that was being done at the time on the NWA being a monopoly. And you can read all about that in Tim Hornbaker's book on the NWA. He goes into detail on that. But the storyline was within 90 days or we would not recognize Pat O'Connor as the champion anymore. That's where the confusion comes with a lot of people that do title histories, because they think that Pat O'Connor was listed as the AWA champion. And when he didn't defend to Vern, Vern becomes AWA champ. In August of 60, the 90 days is up. Pat O'Connor ignored the challenge. This is what we're hearing on TV. It's in the programs. And again, I have these programs. It's all printed out. Pat O'Connor did not accept the challenge. So we are now recognizing Vern Gagne as the new AWA World Heavyweight Champion, and Vern started his own company. That, to me, that's the beginning. And so that's why it always has to be one of the great angles for me in my history, because I think it starts with Vern Gagne finally being the world champion. And of course, the rest is history after that. But Pat O'Connor was not AWA champ. And no matter where you read it is, sorry, folks, didn't happen.
Let me ask you, George. So Vern is the inaugural AWA champion. Who is his first challenger or guy? Not necessarily that he gave a brief run to, but who's his first big challenger after he becomes the AWA champion?
One of the first ones was Gene Kaniski. When Vern started the AWA and actually branched out on his own from 59 on, he had a handful of guys that he brought in because the NWA was pulling out, and Vern called in basically a lot of friendships. He had Wilbur Snyder working with him. He had Leo Nomalini. He had Tiny Mills, Stan Kowalski, Hardboiled Haggerty, Lenny Montana, Joe Scarpello, his good buddy, and Gene Kaniski. And Gene Kaniski had the first, probably the biggest challenger at the time, and had just a short run of just, without looking at the dates, it was, again, a coffee break. But Gene Kaniski does hold the honor of having been AWA world champion and being the only guy to ever hold both the NWA and the AWA. On a lesser note, he held the WWA title in Bruiser's Group. And he had a good run with Bruno Sammartino out east, too, in the first part of the 60s. But yeah, Gene Kaniski would be the guy.
Okay, so now let's go to number six. Dick Beyer removes his mask for a Jack Lanza mask or match.
This is one of the fun ones. Dick Beyer came into... When I say Minneapolis, I'm talking AWA, because all the wrestlers will say they went to Minneapolis, because that's the headquarters, okay? So Vern Gagne had been wrestling in Chicago, which he and Bruiser promoted together, and there were always a lot of crossovers with Bruiser's group and Vern's group on Chicago cards. Well, the Destroyer had been wrestling for the Bruiser, and he was on a Chicago card. He actually wrestled against Vern as the Destroyer in Chicago. After the match, Vern got together with Dick Beyer, the Destroyer, and both of them said this, so I think it's true. They said they went to the Playboy Club in Chicago, and they talked over a business deal. Vern wanted Dick to come in to Minneapolis, and Dick right away said, well, I'll come in, but you know I won't unmask. And Vern said, well, that would obviously be something we'd want to work with at the end of your run. We'd probably want you to unmask. And Dick says, I'm not going to do it. You know, and that's the Destroyer thing. So in 1967, he's 5 years into his Destroyer run, and that was part of his... He was one of the probably the few masked wrestlers that were able to pull that off with any promoter. and say, I'll go in and work for you, but I will not take my mask off because this is my livelihood now. And then I am a draw, and this is how I make money, and I'll work for you as long as you want, but I won't unmask. Well, Vern and him worked out a deal. We won't bring in the destroyer. We'll bring in a different masked man. And Dick went along with that, and Vern said, okay, will you unmask at the end of the run, whenever that is? And Dick agreed. So the destroyer was never unmasked. We know that. But we get to June after 3 years. 67 August is when the destroyer, the Dr. X, debuted. And there's a nice story that goes with that because they played at the fan in the audience, the masked man sitting at ringside. And he come out a few times and said he wanted to have a match. He was told to sit down by security. And he keeps interfering. And they keep putting him back in his seat. Finally, after a few weeks go by, Vern Gagne, the champion, is in the ring with Jack Pesek in a match, a TV match. Vern has the sleeper hold on Jack Pesek. From out of the seat in the front row of the studio jumps this guy with the mask. First time he's jumped into action. He goes up on the top rope, comes down on the back of Vern Gagne's neck. Vern falls to the mat. The masked man puts the figure four leg lock on him. And Vern is screaming in agony. And finally, he says, uncle, and the masked man releases the hold, comes out on his interview, and he says, for weeks I've been coming out here asking for a match. I just beat your world champion. Now I deserve a match. Well, that's how he started in the territory. So he had a great buildup. For the next 3 years, like any territory, what wrestler can remove the mask? Who is behind the, who, you know, what's the face behind the mask? Who is he? And they throw out names. Is it Buddy Rogers? Is it Bill Miller? Is it Gene Kaniski? He wrestles against everybody. The Crusher, Igor, Johnny Powers, Doug Gilbert, Rene Goulet, on and on and on. Cowboy Bill Watts, Harley Race, you name it. Nobody beats the masked man. We get to June of 70, and Dick had decided that he wanted to take some time off. He was going to go, and he had actually set up his own tour around the country, around the world. He was going to take a world tour as the destroyer, and he had set up matches in New Zealand and Australia and Japan and every place. He was in Singapore, and he went around and he set these matches up, and he was taking his family on a world tour. So he went to Vern in June of 70, and he said, I want to take some time off, about a year. And that was when they agreed that we're going to do the unmasking. And Dick agreed. In most of the AWA towns, Duluth, Winnipeg, and there's a few others, it was either Jack Lanza as a heel or Paul Diamond, who was one of the biggest baby faces at the time in the area. They got the kudos for unmasking Dick Beyer or Dr. X in those towns. But they actually beat him and took his mask off, but they never revealed him as Dick Beyer. He was revealed as Bruce Marshall, a fictitious name. When it got to St. Paul, St. Paul was the only city that had a different angle that none of the other cities had. Jack Lanza and Dr. X were a tag team, a short-lived tag team, with Bobby Heenan as their manager. They're on All-Star Wrestling. They're signed after the TV card that night to wrestle against Red Bastien and Pepper Gomez in a tag team match in Minneapolis. Well, during the TV match, Lanza and Heenan have issues with Dr. X in the ring. It ended up being 2-on-1. They turned on Dr. X. So that night, the card was immediately changed. It was Dr. X versus Blackjack Lanza in a grudge match, and they flipped Bastien and Gomez to go against Larry Hennig and Lars Anderson. So it was one of those cards where the program you have at home has to be changed because none of the names were matching.
The cards, on as always, night, George, are subject to change.
Yes, of course.
Go ahead.
Okay, so that night, Dr. X is beaten to a bloody pulp, and his mask is actually pulled off, but he's all covered with blood, and he throws a towel over his face, and he gets out of the ring, goes back to the dressing room. That night, Heenan and Lanza got the upper hand. So the angle in St. Paul was, Dr. X comes screaming out the following week on TV wrestling, and he says, I want Carbo out here right now. Carbo comes out, and Wally Carbo was genius because he would stammer and stutter over his words. I mean, he played the part so well. And Dr. X looks at him, and he said, Carbo, I want a match with Lanza. Carbo says, well, I don't know if I can get Jack to agree to another match, and, you know, he's got other challengers that want to get a chance at him. And Dr. X, it was done so well because Dr. X looks at him, he says, I don't think you're listening to me, Carbo. I want a match with Jack Lanza. And I will take off my mask to get a match. He says, for 3 years, you put everybody against me. I've done everything you've asked me to do. And now I'm telling you, I'll take my, and Carbo goes, you'll what? You'll take off your mask? And all of a sudden, Carbo goes, you got yourself a match. So now we've got this situation where the only city of the AWA that's going to get supposedly Dr. X removing his mask. He agreed to take it off before the match started. And the match was going to take place in St. Paul. Marty O'Neill gets in the ring. St. Paul promoter Eddie Williams comes and stands in the corner. Dr. X comes out, stands in the corner with his arms folded like he always did. And miraculously, Marty O'Neill starts telling the fans about who Dr. X is. He said, fans, he's a former coach from Syracuse University and amateur background. Here he is, Dick Beyer. Introduced him as Dick Beyer. And Dick peeled his mask off, handed it to Eddie Williams, wrestled the match with Lanza as a babyface without his mask as Dick Beyer. Lanza was the new heel in town that was really getting the big push, and he was the new one to take over. So Dick did the honors. He was beaten pretty badly by him, and Dick was gone. Then the programs are reading after that, will Dr. X reappear? We know he had a tough time of it in his last outing. What happened to Dr. X? But never, ever again was Dick Beyer mentioned. It was just in that one match. Now, the funny story here is that I don't know if either of you guys have ever read Dick Beyer's book, Masked Decisions.
I have not.
Either of you?
Very.
Okay. No, I have not.
Okay. It's a great book. If you ever get a chance, it's worth picking up. Masked Decisions. And it's basically Dick Beyer's own words about his career as Dick Beyer, Dr. X, and the Destroyer. He goes into a lot of detail about his travels and about his family, a lot of personal stuff revealed. It was interesting when he did the book, and throughout the book, the writer for him, Vince Evans, him and I were in contact, and Dick actually sent me an email, and he said, would you work with Vince on any facts or things that, you know, he may need for the book? Well, when the book came out, the only thing Dick talks about in the book are his unmasking when his tenure as Dr. X was done, that he was revealed as Bruce Marshall. And he talks about how the Bruce Marshall name came about. It was a combination of some salesperson in Duluth and somebody else. They put the two names together or something like that. But after the fact, I said to Dick, I said, Dick, you're blowing my mind. You never put in the St. Paul story. And he goes, I forgot all about it. I said, well, that was the whole reason that we were always talking about it. So he was Dick Beyer in one match. A year after he left, he came back. He started out to come back as a villain, a heel, and he was still, they still never mentioned him being unmasked. Now that was forgotten once he came back. And he came back as a heel, and they did a quick babyface turn with him. Two things happened. They had him work with Larry Hennigan, a tag match when Lars Anderson supposedly had a banged up arm and couldn't wrestle. And during the match, Hennig was breaking the rules and X was telling the referee, watch his knee. He's got something in his knee, you know, about Larry. And Larry and him got into a shoving match. And then Larry and Lars worked Dr. X over. That started the babyface turn. And then he had Ray Stevens when Dick had to go in and have his. He had to have surgery on his knee. And so they had the TV bout that's on YouTube out there where Ray Stevens came off the top rope on his bombs away type move, came down on Dr. X's leg when he was tangled up in the ropes and broke his leg. And that explained him being gone. And of course, when he came back, he had a ready-made feud with Ray, and he'd already had things going on with Larry and Lars, so he was a bona fide babyface. But that's always been one of my best angles that I've enjoyed through the years.
Isn't it funny, George, how stuff that, you know, like you talked about the St. Paul story, just completely stuck with you, whereas Dick was, you know, forgot about it when he was writing his biography. And, you know, one of the things I've always noticed is things as a fan that stick with you. I always reference the CWF angle involving the Iron Sheik, J.J. Dillon, and Killer Carl Cox in early 1982, and how that angle just appealed to me so much as a fan. And when I mentioned it to J.J. Dillon, he had no idea what I was talking about. He's like, I don't remember that at all.
So, well, the thing on this one is Dick did remember it. But, you know, there'd been three, four, or five towns that he was unmasked as Bruce Marshall, and that was the highlight of it. And he was, you know, if you get his book, you'll see how he gets to the point that his time in the AWA had come to an end, that first run, and how they worked out the doing the mask thing. The interesting thing about this, too, is that from June to August of 70, Dick had given his notice to Vern. And for the next 3 months, they worked through these matches. The first thing they did in July was they brought in Bill Miller again with his Mr. M mask on that he had had on 8 years earlier, 6 years earlier in the AWA as Mr. M. And they brought him in as Bill Miller, but he's called Mr. M with the mask. And we're going to have a battle of the masks then. And he'll probably be the one to take the Dr. X mask off. Well, at that same time, Dr. X, and he tells this story in the book too. We had wrestler Jim Osborne working here at the time from about the spring of 70. And he was wrestling as Jim Osborne, and he was mid-card. Vern wasn't really doing anything with him. And Dick went to Vern and he said, give me Osborne. We're going to put a mask on him. Now, if you looked at, and he called him Double X. That's what the deal was. Now, if you look at pictures of Doc and Double X, they're almost build-wise and appearance-wise just carbon copies. So it was a genius move. And Dick said to me, he was at my house when he said this. He said, Vern didn't know what to do with Osborne. So I said, give them to me. We're going to make something out of this. So they had in the Mr. M match with Dick, they had Dick ended up getting clubbed and thrown out of the ring, and out from under the ring appeared Double X while the referee wasn't looking and came into the ring, and fans thought it was Dr. X or were screaming that they had switched. And Mr. M beat Osborne, pulled off his mask, and it wasn't Dick Beyer at that point. So now Dick had escaped getting unmasked again, leading up to the Lanza thing later in the summer. So they played it out a lot over the summer. It was an angle that worked for a long time. Who can unmask him in this period of time?
Gotcha. Well, George, based off of time, we are actually going to have to wrap up this segment, but we still have the top five to go. Will you come back? Will you join us? Will you reveal what you feel are the top five most important angles in the history of the AWA?
I'd love to.
All right.
That's good, because if you didn't want to, boy, we'd leave the audience hanging, wouldn't we?
We can't do that. But before we go,
isn't there an old story? You have to leave them wanting more.
Exactly.
There you go. George,
Vern Gagne told me, he said, one of the things about drawing wrestling, he said, when we're on TV, we have to get them to come and buy a ticket to go to the matches that night or next week. And he said, then the next problem is when we've got them at the arena, now we've got to give them a reason to come back next week. He said, that's the whole story on pro wrestling. So yeah, maybe we should just leave it that I'll come back, but we don't know when.
We can always say that Barry Rose is the Vern Gagne of podcasters.
There you go.
There you go. Absolutely. Well, George, before we do go, and we want to thank you, obviously, for your time today, your knowledge that you have dropped on us. You, sir, much like my partner, Jeffrey Wayne Baudrin, you are a published author. I know that I think you've written more than one book. I do have one of your books, but where can our listeners go to purchase these books?
Well, the primary book that I think is the Bible for anybody to get if they're interested in the AWA, it's called Minnesota's Golden Age of Wrestling, From Vern Gagne to the Road Warriors. Though the title on the book says Minnesota, it's basically an AWA history. And I will just say that the only reason it has Minnesota in it is because it was published by the Minnesota Historical Society, and they wanted to have Minnesota in the title. But it is a history of the AWA. It is available on Amazon.com, of course, and any major bookstore can have it, Barnes & Noble. I would be glad if anyone picked it up. I think it's a great book. And I do have three other books out that are all results, trivia, and history-oriented AWA record books. They also are on Amazon.
Okay, and Jeffrey, you have two books out. I know I've read these books cover to cover. Our listeners, I know, have purchased these, but Jeff, where can we get your books?
I believe they are available through crowbarpress.com, and our good friend Scott Teal, who George referenced earlier in the show. Thank you for the plug, Mr. Rose. George, we really appreciate it, buddy, and we're going to have fun having you back for part two, where you reveal your top five AWA angles. How about that?
I look forward to it. And just to answer something you said earlier, when you said it seems like they're Larry Hennig and some of these guys appear in several of these angles, I think it'd be that same way with any territory where the mainstays in the territory are the ones that all the stories are usually built around. And maybe that's the reason that happens that way.
Or maybe it's just they were really good.
They were.
Yeah,
they were.
Exactly. So thanks, George. We appreciate it, buddy.
I think you'll love my number one because that one to me has the most fascinating story to it.
Well, see, there you go. Teasing the audience again.
Okay. Thank you, guys.
Okay. Okay, so Barry, let's return to your favorite topic. It's the top 1,000 list. It's the Harold Strassler Memorial List, as I'm sure we'll have more things to complain about because as I was glancing at our list, we're now up to 200, by the way. We're counting down the final 200. Let's start at number 195. There's a little song called Spirit of Radio I think we might be familiar with, Barry.
So you know what bothers me about that? The song that's right above that at 194. Oh, my God.
Yeah. The Cars at 194 with Let's Go.
Yeah.
And at 195, we have Spirit of Radio. Cars also in front of Knights in White Satin, Jet Airliner. There's so much troubling about this list. Here's another. Is this really a classic rock song? Chicago's Beginnings at 188, Barry.
Yeah, so we've had this discussion, Jeff, over the last few weeks, and I'll be so happy today when this thing is fucking over and we don't have to talk about this list anymore. But do bands like Chicago, and I guess maybe Beginnings is a good example of that. Is that by definition a classic rock song, Jeff?
I don't think so. I think it's a pop group. I mean, they had some kind of, I don't even want to say, like when they first came out, they were very, they were different from everybody else, but
right.
I don't know, they could really be classified as a rock band.
They were kind of jazzy too, right?
Yeah. A lot of horns.
What was the original name of the band? Chicago Transit Authority.
Yeah. Something
right.
like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
But let's see what else we got. We got Procol Harum, Whiter Shared of Pale at 185. 184, Yes, Roundabout. 183, Paul McCartney, of course, a classic rock icon, but it's another day, really. I mean, do you hear that on the classic rock stations?
I'm not sure that I even know which song Another Day is, Jeff.
Okay, well, that's why it's at number 183. Let's talk Heart, 180, Crazy on You.
Fantastic song. That's an absolutely fantastic song. And again, briefly looking at this list, when I see some songs that are ahead of it, I say to myself, how is this absolutely possible? What happens with these? And we've talked about this numerous times. I hate the people that are the judges for this because you're literally being held captive by their selections. These aren't in any way the top 1,000 classic rock songs in any sort of order. This is strictly the opinion of a few assholes that are out there that are probably, Jeff, as we are recording this episode, the fuckers that wrote this list are probably not social distancing. I might be wrong, but that's what I'm thinking right now.
That's a bold statement.
Absolutely it is.
Speaking of bold statements, how about 174? Let's return to our friend Harold. The Cars, My Best Friend's Girl at 174. The 174th greatest song in classic rock history.
poor Harold. Yeah, Thank God Harold, and Harold loves both of us. We both consider Harold a friend, but obviously he doesn't listen to the show because we've been beating the shit up out of the cars the last few weeks. So according to this list, the Cars, I think every Cars song is on this list, which again tells you there is at least one or two major Cars fans that came up with the list, which again, completely, in my opinion, this list should be tossed in the garbage. I don't see it.
Yeah. Well, let's see. How about Piano Man 170? Is that a classic rock? I mean, it's played sometimes on classic rock stations. I think that's more of an oldie song now. I know Chris Zaha is probably fainting now because I've in some way disparaged Billy Joel. What do you think? Piano Man, a classic rock song?
And the Professor, Peter Lederberg, also another, maybe the second, I think maybe the biggest Billy Joel fan that I've ever met. He and Zaha both. But so is, look, Billy Joel, whatever. But at the same time, do you classify the song Piano Man as a classic rock song? That to me seems as far possibly away from classic rock as you can get, right?
It's funny because a couple in front of that, we have Judas Priest, Living After Midnight, you know, the Eagles,
that's
Life
classic
and Fest.
Rock.
Yeah, you know, but yeah. I don't consider that the same genre, you know, which is the first time I think we've used the word genre in quite a while.
Genre.
So let's see. We got Bob Seger, Hollywood Nights at 154. And here again, 151, Rolling Stones, Ruby Tuesday. That again, is somebody forgot to mention Ruby Tuesday up in the 800s and said, oh, shit, that's a classic rock song. We need to put it on there.
I wonder when they opened up the restaurant chain Ruby Tuesday, if any financial consideration was tossed the way of Mick Jagger and the rest of the Stones. What do you think about that one, Jeff?
You know, I was thinking about that, you know, but it's not Ruby Tuesday. It's Ruby Tuesdays. So, you know, but you're absolutely right. Could be some cash that was thrown Mick and Keefe's way. So let's see. 148, Van Halen, Ain't Talking About Love.
What a great fucking song that is, too. And that's one that I go into classic. Like, if I think of classic rock, that would be right there for me. Absolutely. Yeah. Fantastic song.
Yeah. 146, Creedence, Fortunate Son.
Great song.
You know, great song. ZZ Top, Tush. Let's see. We got Fleetwood Mac, Gold Dust Woman, which is like one of their most underrated songs.
Not sure if I know that one also.
That's a Stevie Nicks classic. Let's see. 137, The Police, Every Breath You Take. Good Lord, in 1983, that was like everywhere, that song. You couldn't escape it.
Yeah, isn't that song about a stalker?
It's about a stalker, and people use it as their wedding song.
Right. Did you ever see that movie? We did talk about that. The movie, it's a Stephen King movie, Cat's Eye. Did you ever see that?
No, I never saw it. I know the one you're talking about, though.
So it's like an anthology-type movie where there's three, four stories in there, but one of them is about a guy where long story short, the guy's trying to quit smoking, and the company that he goes to takes these really extreme measures to get him to stop smoking. And
I actually read the short story.
Okay, so you know what I'm talking about, right? And that's what I think it's based off of. It's based off of a bunch of his short stories. The guy in charge was Alan King, the late Alan King. He was fantastic. But they really used that song, Every Breath You Take, to the point that I almost liked it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's the anthology books that Stephen King puts out are usually really good. Let's see. We got 135, Purple Haze, Jimi Hendrix. 134, Steve Miller Band, The Joker. And then I love the way they, 131, The Stones, not Heartbreaker. It's Do, 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 Heartbreaker.
Right.
So you're not confused there, you know.
I'm going to tell you this, though. So when I looked, I didn't see the Stones. When I looked at the list, I saw Do, Do, Do. And it made me think of one of the worst songs in rock and roll history, which is the Police song, Do, 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 Da, 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 Da. And if that's on this fucking list, Jeff, and I don't know if we've already passed it, but if that's in the top 125, I may just walk off the show today.
You may have to quit.
I may have to quit. Right. Well, the paycheck won't come in any longer. But yeah.
Speaking of, here we go again, 129, The Cars, Good Time Roll. Are we sure that Harold didn't actually do this list?
Harold may be on maybe one of the judges, yes.
He could be. So let's see. 126, The Beatles, Hey Jude. I'm really surprised, just because that's such a popular song on the classic rock radio stations, that that's not higher.
Yeah, I'd agree with that, too.
Yeah. Let's see. We got 120, Phil Collins, In the Air Tonight. That's another one that's like a classic of of classic rock radio, you know, seemingly played on a daily basis.
Yeah, and I think it's been released and made its way on the charts, I think, three times. As a single, I know Miami Vice was responsible, then something else I was reading, but that is one of those classic songs. If I never heard it again, I'd be okay, but I got to admit, the first 6 months when that song was released, I was heavily into it.
Yeah. I mean, you couldn't escape it. It was everywhere.
Right.
So let's see. 116, Paul McCartney and Wings, Band on the Run. 114, Fleetwood Mac, Don't Stop. That was, of course, it was Clinton's campaign song, wasn't it, when he was first ran for president?
With somebody's, yeah. I don't know if it was Clinton. It was somebody's.
Yeah, let's see. 109, Bob Seger, Turn the Page, another song that seemingly is inescapable on classic rock radio. I'm kind of surprised it's not a little bit higher.
Yeah, and you just passed over three that I think we have to point out, especially one of those.
Is it a car song?
No, that's coming up, though, I'm sure. 111, War Lowrider. My God, that's classic rock and roll. Number 113, Allman Brothers Band, Midnight Rider. But 112, Jeff, this arguably might be one of the most famous songs in rock and roll history. It's Kashmir by Led Zeppelin. Obviously, iconicized. Is that a word, or did I just make that up?
No, I think you're correct.
All right, iconicized. Right, exactly. Yeah. In Fast Times, everybody knows that song.
Of course, yes, because you, and they screwed it up, didn't they? Because they said you, whatever you want to score, you play, side B of Led Zepp 4, and that's like apparently either not on Led Zepp 4 or it's on side A, so they screwed it up in the editing process. Yeah. So let's see, we got 104 Styx, Renegade, 103 Van Halen, Everybody Wants Some.
Let me ask you a question. When you hear that song, I think, so that's my one of my top, we should do a top five Van Halen songs, which would be really difficult, but that's got to be in there for me. What do you think of when you hear the song Everybody Wants Some?
I don't know.
Does anything pop into your mind? There was a scene in a movie where they really utilized this song well, and it was Better Off Dead, 1984's Better Off Dead with John Cusack. He's working in the hamburger joint, and he's cooking burgers one night, and they start to play this song, and the burgers, I guess, come to life. And I just thought it was just such a great scene. It's an amazing song. Alex Van Halen, really underrated. I don't know shit when it comes to music, obviously, but Alex Van Halen is a drummer, I just think, is just really one of the best drummers out there.
Well, and you know what's great about this Van Halen song is it's one below Ringo Starr's Photograph. Are you fucking kidding me? I mean, God bless Ringo, but I don't even think Ringo would think that.
Yeah. Again, it's the 102nd best classic rock song of all time, Photograph by Ringo Starr. Not Photographed by Def Leppard, which is actually, I think, a really good song. But Photograph, again, I'm not sure that I know this song, Jeff. Am I supposed to know this song?
Well, you know, Ringo had he had the singles and stuff, but I just don't understand. You know, you want to throw it in the 900s, maybe. I don't know that any Ringo Starr song deserves to be this high up on the list. So here's where I start to have. Let's creep into the top 100, Barry. So when I first looked at this, the number 100 song, David Bowie's Space Oddity. How in God's name is that all the way at 100 and not somewhere in the top 25?
Yeah, and it's even less, Jeff, when I start to look at, because now I'm looking at the list and the songs that are in front of that, and it's disgusting. As I look at this, number 97 is a classic rock song, and that's above David Bowie's Space Oddity, which really, if you were going to ask, let's say, the average person, not a massive David Bowie fan, there's a good chance Space Odyssey is going to be the song that they remember David Bowie for.
Yeah. And, again, here we go. I hate to say it, Harold, but 92 is Just What I Needed by the Cars. Now, that they have Just What I Needed as a better song than Tom Sawyer by Rush. And one behind Black Sabbath's Iron Man.
Well, I mean, again, when you start to look at this, it's, you know, even number 101, Jeff, the Who Are You?
Yeah.
So the Cars, Just What I Needed is higher than,
I think we may have hit on something the last couple of times we talked about this, and the fact that Rick Ocasek's death obviously has influenced somebody, you know, because there's just way too many Cars songs way too high on this list for that to have not played some part in it. So let's see. Number 84, U2's New Year's Day, which was like early U2 before they got really pretentious. Let's see. 82.
That's a good rock song, though.
You know, it is. Yeah, the early stuff I liked.
Yeah, I wouldn't have an issue with that at all.
Yeah. Let's see. We got 79, Watching the Wheels by John Lennon. It's a great John Lennon song. I don't know if it deserves to be this high, though.
Yeah, that was his last single, right?
Well, let's see. I think it might have been the last one from that album. I think that they released a posthumous album where the song Nobody Told Me There'd Be Days Like This got released.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Hey, how about me coming through every once
Hey.
Lion Squirrel gets an acorn out again. Okay. 73, Can't Get No Satisfaction. You know, again, based on airplay, that's way too low.
Yeah. So again, the one thing I think of, you remember the great movie with Michael Keaton and Henry Winkler, Night Shift? Do you remember that movie?
Yes.
So there's a scene in there where Michael Keaton, Bill Blazejowski, is driving the limo, and he's got Clint Howard, Ron Howard's younger brother, in the back seat, and he's taking him to his prom. Forget about the fact that Clint Howard was like 40 at the time, but he's taking him to his prom, and he says, "Hey, kid, do you like music?" And he goes, "Yeah." And he goes, That's what I think of whenever I see that song.
Oh, let's see.
That's a fantastic movie, by the way. I don't know the last time you watched that, Jeff.
Yeah, but no. Would keep the little voice recorder and make notes to himself, right?
This is Bill. This is Chuck reminding Bill to shut the hell up. Remember that? Playing that? But that is just still a funny movie some 38 years later.
Yeah. Let's see what else we got here. And again, Satisfaction behind Already Gone by the Eagles. No. And behind Ringo Starr's It Don't Come Easy. No. And you know my feelings for Jethro Tull at 69, Locomotive Breath. No. Barry, what are we going to do about this list? 67, The Who's Love Rain or Me. That's a great song.
Yeah, and look, 66, Judas Priest, Breaking the Law. Love it or hate it. Boy, that's classic rock right there. Yeah. That I get, yeah.
Behind Simon and Garfunkel's Mrs. Robinson. Again, is that really classic rock?
That I don't get quite as much, correct.
Yeah, let's see. We got 59, Jefferson Airplane, A Little Druggy Music with White Rabbit.
Yeah, and I actually like that song. And let me say, I just fucked up before somebody points that out. I'm going, that's Jumpin' Jack Flash, which is number 60.
Thank you. I bet it was Harold Strassler pointing that out, probably.
Yeah, no, I would. But somebody, one of our crack Facebook group members would have had me 6 minutes after the show drops. That's the best part of it. But how about with this? How about we go to 57? Led Zeppelin, The Immigrant Song. I think of classic rock, and I should say too, Jeff, maybe our definition is obviously not the same definition as these assholes that came up with the list, but bands like the Rolling Stones, the Beatles, AC/DC, Led Zeppelin, that's classic rock. The Cars really, to me, aren't classic rock.
No. They're like new wave pop, you know, kind of, is that completely off base?
They're new wave. I mean, you can make a case. New wave does it exist any longer because of the fact that it's 40 years ago? But I don't see them as classic rock, pop rock. Yeah, I don't know.
And you know, of course, when you hear the Immigrant Song, of course, you immediately think of.
Oh, exactly. I think of a wild man, 6'5", swinging a chain, hitting Japanese wrestling fans in the head. That's what I'm thinking of.
The barking bad boy, Bruiser Brody. Yes.
Absolutely.
Right behind Sweet Judy Blue Eyes by Crosby, Stills. It's the same thing.
Oh, yeah. They're almost identical. I would get confused.
Crosby, Stills, and Nash, Sweet Judy Blue Eyes is sandwiched between Led Zeppelin, The Immigrant Song, and Black Sabbath's Paranoid. It's like the same thing, people, isn't it? Oh, let's see. 52, Van Halen, Unchained. 51, I have a real problem with, Barry, because I love the song Comfortably Numb by Pink Floyd, and that's way too low on this.
Yeah, Pink Floyd, all those bands I just mentioned, you got to add Pink Floyd to those bands as well, because that is absolutely classic rock. And I love you know, I don't always love the politics of some of the group members, but I got to say that I absolutely love the music of Pink Floyd. Absolutely.
Yeah. And let's see, we got War Pigs at 48, Led Zeppelin, Rock and Roll right behind it at 49. And so here again, we got Queens, We Will Rock You, We Are the Champions at number 45, right behind Van Morrison's Brown Eyed Girl. Now, I like Brown Eyed Girl. It's a good song, but I don't know how you group that song in with some of the other things we just listed. And, you know, right between We Will Rock You and We Are the Champions and Highway to Hell is Van Morrison's Brown Eyed Girl. Barry, what do you think? Classic rock or no?
No. It's a great song. Everybody loves Van Morrison. Everybody loves that song. But I mean, the dichotomy of, you know, that song being wedged between We Will Rock You, We Are the Champions and Highway to Hell. But even going back, LaGrange at 46, and then you look at 42, Baba O'Reilly. My God, that's the definition of classic rock. Brown Eyed Girl, not so much, at least in my opinion.
Yeah, and then 40, George Harrison's My Sweet Lord, which, I understand that George Harrison, you know, is considered classic rock. I don't know that My Sweet Lord is really a classic rock song, though.
No, and look, 41, maybe my favorite Tom Petty, certainly top three favorite Tom Petty songs, Running Down a Dream, great video, should definitely be a little bit higher. But, you know, look, I'll go to 35 just because U2, very, very polarizing band, and some people love them, some hate them. I think a lot of it's got to be, as you just alluded to and mentioned earlier, the pretentiousness of Bono and the band, but I still haven't found what I'm looking for when they've got some kick-ass stuff, especially the early stuff was rock and roll. I still haven't found what I'm looking for.
Yeah. And let's see. At 34, Dire Straits, Money for Nothing, another classic rock radio, just a staple that you're always going to hear, you know, once a day. And then you throw in like Maybe I'm Amazed by Paul McCartney. Again, a great song. And 32, Take It Easy by the Eagles. These aren't staples of classic rock, you know, radio.
No, they're not even close. And that's the difference right there, is that if you're going to do a classic rock list, why not look at what radio stations have defined themselves? You've got classic rock radio, you have easy listening, soft rock, whatever it might be. That's exactly where a song like that would belong.
Yeah. And then let's see, we got Behind Blue Eyes by the Who. I think is a great song. I can't believe they have it this high. Because, you know, other songs that the Who have done that we just talked about, you know, Love Rain or Me, to me, that's more of a staple of classic rock than Behind Blue Eyes.
Yeah, yeah. There's
24, Petty Refugee, another great Petty song. 23, Springsteen's Born to Run. I can't believe they had this this low, you know.
Yeah.
But let's see, we got, and the Stones, 20, Gimme Shelter, another great song, but I can't believe they have it this high as opposed to some of the other Stones songs.
Yeah, and as I'm starting to look at the list now, and I'm seeing what the top 20 are, I for the most part, I think I would disagree with about 75% of those choices. What I also get from that, this is very safe for them. They know by putting, let's say, those top five, well, the top four songs, or and then number six, I don't get number five, but number six also, these are the safe songs. So you've got a list where you're making no sense for the most part, and then you decide to completely cut your testicles off, play this safe in the top 10. Because you look at the top 10, and literally seven of those songs are the safest choices you could possibly make.
Yeah, well, let's since we're down this close, why don't we just roll them out here? Number 20, The Stones, Gimme Shelter. Number 19, The Beatles, Here Comes the Sun. Number 18, AC/DC, Back in Black. Number 17, U2's Pride in the Name of Love. 16, Queen, Bohemian Rhapsody, which I'm really surprised it's not a little bit higher. 15, Led Zeppelin's Black Dog. 14, Pink Floyd, Another Brick in the Wall, Part 2. 13, Skinner's Sweet Home Alabama. 12, The Doors, Light My Fire. Why is that high? I don't understand. I don't really hear.
Yeah. So, Jeff, going off of this, this is where this list, if it completely lost all credibility three episodes, you look at the top 15. So The Doors, Light My Fire is the best Doors song. Another Brick in the Wall, Part 2 is the best Pink Floyd song. Sweet Home Alabama is the best Skinner song. Give me a fucking break.
Okay, and then we got number 11, Boston's More Than a Feeling, Sweet Emotion by Aerosmith. I don't consider that the best Aerosmith song
No.
either. So. Let's see. Number 9, Van Halen's Eruption, and You Really Got Me. I don't think that's the best Van Halen song. Here we go. The Eagles' Hotel California.
At of course, 8. Had to be on there, right? Yeah. Had to be in the top 10, sure.
7, The Who's Won't Get Fooled Again. 6, Rolling Stones' Sympathy for the Devil. A great song, but I don't think that's the most played Stone song at this point, you know.
No, but it's pandering. It's pandering to a certain audience because it's Sympathy for the Devil. They've got much, much, much better songs.
Yeah. Okay, now 5 and 4, okay? Dylan's Knocking on Heaven's Door at 5. I'm sorry, I just don't get that. 4, Jimi Hendrix. I understand wanting to have Jimi Hendrix on here, but putting All Along the Watchtower as a song, you know, Purple Haze, you know, Foxy Lady, something like that. I would understand that being in there, but All Along the Watchtower is a great song, but how often do you hear that song on classic rock radio?
Doesn't matter. It's not the best Jimi Hendrix classic rock song. If you're going to put one, why is that the option? Because it's safe for them. That's why.
So number 3, Derek and the Dominoes' Layla, which is a great song. I completely understand why it's here. Number 2, The Beatles' A Day in the Life. Really? That's the song that you're going to have as your go-to. It's a great song. But again, how often do you hear that song on a classic rock station?
These fucking hipsters, these guys who are coming up with this list, these metrosexuals, these guys with these perfectly sculpted hipster beers, drinking IPAs and fucking macchiato lattes with caramel flavoring, coming up with a
probably got a
day
man
in the
bun.
Life at number 2. Got it. There you go. It's the best thing you possibly. They definitely have man buns. And then you get to number 1, Jeff, and number
now, wait,
1.
This is but the number one Howard Baum, number 1, because I told Howard that he's going to hate this list when he hears what number 1 is. Because
but he's right. He's absolutely right. Of all the songs, this is so predictable, though. This means this list didn't take a chance. It wasn't trying to be risky. This is where you're putting on all this obscure shit in the 500 and 600 range that nobody's ever heard of. And then you choose this as number 1. Why? Because you know that you're pandering to a certain audience.
So number 1, of course, as Howard has now figured out, is Led Zeppelin's Stairway to Heaven. You know, from a strictly a playlist, it's a song you hear every day on any classic rock station that you turn on. I mean, you're going to hear Stairway to Heaven. It's just a staple. But again, you're absolutely right. They played it safe, didn't want to upset the apple cart. And, you know, in doing so, did they delegitimize the list? Well, it's already been delegitimized, I think, by Mr. Rose and myself. But no risk taking other than putting, 34 Cars songs on here.
Yeah, exactly. I'm thrilled this is over.
I'll have to come up with another classic rock list that can piss everybody off.
Yeah.
Barry, before we go, I would be remiss if we did not once again mention our friend Ian Totten and his book that has been released. Why don't we talk about The Throwaway Girls of Olympia?
Yeah, absolutely, Jeff. And you've always been a bigger reader than I have. I'll talk to you and you'll say, you know, I'm reading this book or I just read this book. And for me, I don't know if it's a short attention span or what it is, but I haven't been reading over the last few years as much, at least books at least. But with all that's been going on in the world the last month, I've read 3 books, one of those being Ian's book. And I got to tell you, I really love it. I love the fact, first off, that we actually know the guy. That it's not just a great book that I can actually say, wow, you've got somebody here that can really get, you know, deep into his mind and craft this story that's just peppered with all these little things that just make you feel uncomfortable as you're reading the story.
Do we really want to get into Ian's mind based on this book, though?
This is about as far as I want to get with that, Jeff.
Okay, I just want to double check that.
You're 100% correct on that one, Jeff. This is about as far as I want to get with that, but I do. I highly recommend it. And I know that a few of our listeners have purchased a copy of this book as well as his previous works, and they have nothing but the highest of praise. So you can go to Amazon. They are listed on there. You can also visit our Facebook page. But this is kind of cool because you're not only supporting somebody who is really one of us. He is a wrestling fan. He has been part of our Facebook group since probably day one. But, you know, you're supporting an independent artist, a guy that really this is what he wants to do. And to me, That I think that's absolutely one of the greatest things. So highly recommended. Big thumbs up, Jeff. Get this book and do it. Read this book in the middle of the night. Read it after the midnight hour. Turn the lights down and read this book because it will creep the shit out of you.
All righty. Well, so first of all, on behalf of Barry and Lou and myself, we want to thank you for listening. We want to thank George Shire for giving us part one of his top 10 angles in the history of the AWA. So if you want to hear the top five, you got to listen next week. So on behalf of Barry Rose and Lou Kippelman, I am Jeff Baldwin. I would remind you that Breaking Kayfabe, a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. And until next week, we'll talk to you later, folks.